Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to The Powerful Patient. I'm Joyce Graff and I'm delighted to have you with me today. Today we're going to take a little bit of a different tack and talk about another aspect of medical imaging that is very much of interest to our viewers. And we have with us today an expert on this topic that I'll introduce to you in a few minutes. So I think you're going to find this a very interesting show. And before we begin, I wanted to remind everybody that this show is brought to you every week by the VHL Family Alliance. That stands for von Hippel-Lindau disease. And I'm going to play you a little information about VHL, and then we'll be right back to talk with our guest. So please stay tuned, and we'll be right back.
Von Hippel-Lindau disease, or VHL, is a genetic condition involving abnormal growth of tumors in some parts of the body. VHL occurs in every ethnic group worldwide. At this time, there's no cure, but research is helping those afflicted and their families learn how to manage their disease. When a family member has a tumor, it affects everyone in the family. VHL Alliance works to improve diagnosis, treatment, and the quality of life. Finding tumors early, getting the best treatment, and sharing information with others to help them cope is what VHL Alliance is all about. They're available to help lessen the stress of living with this lifetime chronic disease. Support the Cancer Research Fund of the VHL Alliance at VHL.org. That's Very Happy Life, VHL.org. 1-800-767-4-VHL.
Welcome back. And I was recently going through my father's papers, and my father was in Japan 2 weeks after the treaty was signed, and I have a picture of him standing in the rubble at Nagasaki right shortly after the bomb was dropped. And so that was the beginning of our use of radiation for offensive purposes, and we have learned to use radiation both for destruction and also for improvement of health. And so with some of the radiation things that we're familiar with in terms of medicine are X-ray and imaging and also various kinds of therapies. And there's been a lot in the press lately about the use and overuse of radiological imaging. So we're going to talk today with Dr. Michael Feinstein. Hello, welcome, Michael.
Oh, thank you.
And Dr. Feinstein is from Cleveland Biolabs, and they have very interesting new products that are being used to counteract both the offensive characteristics of radiation and the therapeutic results of radiation. So could you tell us a little bit about what your product is and how you happen to get into doing this?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So basically, I need to start from the explanation how radiation really hurts mammals and us as member of this honorable class of life.
Yes, we are all mammals. That's right.
Yeah. So basically, most people think that particles go through matter and destroy and damage it, which is to some extent true. But in reality, what happens when X-ray or, gamma radiation, which is the damaging component, hits a human cell, is most of the radiation doesn't hit molecules, which are important, but instead create so-called reactive oxygen species, which in turn damages molecules. But this primary and secondary damage can be repaired in many, many tissues. However, there is a limited number of hypersensitive tissues, like bone marrow, for instance, or small intestine, which can take very small beating after they decided to go into so-called apoptosis or cell suicide. And the idea behind our drug was that if you can block this cell suicide, then you can increase tolerance of healthy tissues of our body to radiation.
And right. Let's back up for a second because this
sure.
is a concept that I think is sometimes very difficult for people. There's this scientific concept of what's called apoptosis, as you said, or programmed cell death. Now, whenever you say death, people think that's a bad thing. But in fact, there's a sort of life cycle of the cell that's a great deal shorter than a human life cycle. It's sometimes measured in days or years. And it's supposed to live for a while, do its job, and then exit, please, and as you say, commit suicide or just disappear from the scene. But it's a normal part of the cycle of cell life. Did I get that more or less right?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, there is a very strong reason why its presence in us, because it is sort of a watchman, which really protects us from cancer. So cancer cannot develop in our body before this program is not destroyed in a potential procancerous cell.
Mm-hmm.
So it is a very strong reason why it is there. However, if our body, which didn't evolve to deal with systemic application of radiation, meet radiation, then this program misfires.
Mm-hmm.
And our drug prevents this by temporarily stopping it and allowing cells to repair.
For one example, the body has a system of almost like a spell checker. It goes around and it says, is this cell in order? Is this cell healthy? And if it sees that this cell has some problem with it, some damage to it, it's supposed to tell it to please die and we'll make a new cell. But this is the process that, as you say, it can backfire or it gets shortcutted when the cell has been damaged by radiation.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So as you say, it is very important that the body have this self-repair mechanism, this way of going through and saying, wait a minute, you're off on the wrong foot. Just let's get rid of this cell and I'll make a new one that's right. And as long as that process is happening, that's part of our immune defenses.
I mean,
is that right?
Yeah, I mean it's another type of defense. It is related to immune defense because a lot of things are,
mm-hmm.
and final cleanup it does involve, of course, immune system, and
okay.
I would call it just another general defensive mechanism.
Okay, and a lot of this learning came after Chernobyl. Is that right?
Well, Chernobyl was, in some sense, a reason why our scientific founder Andrei Gudkov was inspired to go in this direction. And in reality, people who died in Chernobyl catastrophe, firefighters who received certain amount of radiation, probably would have been saved, or majority of them would, if the drug which we're developing will be available then.
Right. In one of your pieces of material that I read, it said that only about 20-30% of the firefighters who went in to help after Chernobyl survived that event.
In fact, I think it's even less now, but acute effects killed about 70 or 80%, yes.
Wow. So that's really a very high cost, not only in the people who were immediately hit by the event itself, but also in those first responders.
Yeah, that's actually why we believe that what we're doing is quite important. Although,
right.
as you mentioned, radiation is both threat and cure. And when people are thinking about medical radiation, of course, there is this recent high-profile publication saying that there is a danger of overuse. But don't forget that 60% of cancer patients receive radiation treatment of their tumors in the course of normal dealing with their disease, controlling their disease. And we are talking about hundreds of thousands of people who each year undergoing this procedure.
Right, so 60% of all cancer patients undergo some radiation therapy, and that's in addition to the people who get radiation imaging all the time, everything from x-raying your leg to make sure it's not broken to doing CT scans to find out if that tumor has grown.
Yeah, of course.
Right. So we need radiation in our lives for good. We just need to make sure that we don't get too much of it, or that it doesn't sicken us in some other ways. There's also been a lot in the news about terrorism. So there is a lot of interest on the part of the Defense Department in this medication as well.
Oh, that's clearly very material interest from both Department of Defense and Department of Health and Human Services, which is also responsible for preparedness and responses to catastrophic events for civilian population. So basically, to give you some idea of the potency of our drug, which we tested in primates, so we can test the drug in a condition which kills like 80% of primates and generate 70%.
Right, so primates are like monkeys.
Yeah. Non-human primates, of course.
Right. So obviously it would not be ethical to test radiation poisoning on humans, but we can test it on other primates to see how humans might respond.
Yes, and of course each of us have a small list of people we wouldn't mind exposing to some harmful effects, but yes, you cannot do it in a controlled manner.
Right.
And it is said that we're exposing animals to this thing, but you know, each physician who walks through a children's cancer hospital probably would understand the balance.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, my father was an anatomist for 32 years, and we had animals and dogs and goats in the lab. And while you want to treat them with respect, we do need them to help us model things that would help humans in times that we can't really ethically do this on humans. For example, the cure for diabetes, the insulin testing was all done on dogs. Or I saw a billboard the other day that said, have you had, the flesh-eating disease, I'm trying to remember. But anyway.
Staph infection?
Yeah. So, you know, have you had name a horrible disease? And the answer is no, you haven't, and you won't, thanks to testing on animals. So there is time and a place for testing on animals, and this is one that I'm sure you're doing it ethically, but that is one where we absolutely need animals to help us out.
Yeah, but I mean, I just started using this thing to state that we have tremendous qualitative increase in survival, so we can protect 70-80% of, let's say, talk about humans now, who
right.
would be exposed to nearly killing doses of radiation, those which kill 70-80% of the exposed population.
Right, so we would go from 20% of the firefighters surviving
to
60-80% of the firefighters
yes.
surviving, something
yeah.
like that.
Absolutely.
So that's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
So
no, the drug is very, 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 very exciting drug.
So in a case like that, say for as a counterterrorism defense for the country, if God forbid a bomb should be dropped and we tried to inoculate the whole population, what would that look like?
Again, now we're dealing with scenarios of use. Some of them are classified, but basically in a nutshell, the idea is that the drug will be distributed through various field-deployed, efforts, and
right.
people will be injected with this drug. What is good about it, that you have full potency of the effect if it is injected up to 48 hours after the event of exposure. So
even after someone's exposed, they could get this injection up to 2 days later,
yes.
and it would still help them survive.
It will be the same effect as it will be injected immediately. So it's complete plateau of the effect.
Okay. And then you said that if it's injected beforehand, it can be even more helpful. So in a situation where you're getting radiotherapy, and obviously we're planning to expose you to radiation next week or something, what does that look like?
Oh, basically, yes. I mean, I didn't say this, but you obviously did a very good homework. Yes. If the drug is injected before the event of radiation, it gives even higher degree of protection. And that's how we thought the drug will be used in clinical setting.
Mm-hmm.
So we're just about to start our first human trial in clinical use of the drug, whereas we did human trials on safety and animal trials on efficacy with a defense application. On medical side, we're just starting the first trial. But the idea is that each and every person who is subjected to radiation in the clinical setting gets side effects, which everybody will benefit from getting less. In many cases, however, they are regimen threatening. So which means that radiation treatment has to be stopped and patient has to be taken off the course,
mm-hmm.
which allows his tissues healthy tissues to recover, but unfortunately it allows a tumor to recover too.
Right.
So with our drug, we expect there will be less need of this. And again, here we're talking about something which has not been tested yet.
Mm-hmm.
But if you talk to radiation oncologists, they believe that increase in intensity of 20-30% would have dramatically changed therapeutic outcome of radiation treatment.
Mm-hmm.
And if we will be able to translate protective effects, which we see in defense area, into medical arena, we would clearly give much more than that.
Right. So in cases where we're using radiotherapy to try to stop a cancer, one of the things that limits the effectiveness of these treatments is what's called a dose-limiting effect. And that means I can't give you any more because it would kill you, or it would make you so bloody sick you wish you would die. It's not funny. I'm sorry to make a joke about it. But that's a situation where if we had something to reduce those side effects and reduce the bad effects of the radiation, that we could more efficiently kill the tumor without harming the whole person.
Yes, that's exactly the promise of the drug. And by the way, there are said proofs of that you just said is quite precise. Recent publications in major media outlets about basically miscalibrated equipment and what happens to patients.
Right.
So I don't believe that they're receiving doses higher than maybe extra 50-70% of what is considered to be therapeutic dose, but it's already near lethal doses. So the therapeutic window, which is generally the difference between what treats you and what kills you, for radiation is very, very low. That's why if we can stretch this window with drugs like ours, I mean, there are good reasons to expect big impact on cancer treatment.
Right. So right now the focus of your research is primarily in those two areas, both in
Absolutely.
Defense and in radiotherapy.
Yeah, it's acute effects. Strong effects of high doses.
Right. So what about all this stuff in the news about your lifetime maximum exposure to radiation and the more X-rays and CTs you get, the closer you get to it? How might your drug assist with stretching that window?
First of all, our drug is not, unfortunately, it does not clean kitchen sinks and it does not deal with a constant exposure to low doses. So it's not applicable there. With this, we cannot help this. I think here we're dealing with a more complicated, situation of risk-benefit analysis.
Mm-hmm.
If there is a serious predisposition to a disease, deadly disease like cancer,
mm-hmm.
I believe that the more diagnostic assays is the better. Obviously, these things should be balanced.
Right.
But I believe also, and I don't, it's not my belief, I think it's a widespread opinion, that majority of improvement in cancer treatment is due to early diagnostic today.
Right. Yeah, we need that imaging in order to improve the treatment profile and the quality of life. But there are situations, for example, there was one in the news recently where a young child was given too many CTs all in a row and did have some radiation poisoning. So in a situation like that, would you potentially use your drug?
I don't think so. And again, to some extent, this is man-bites-dog situation. Again, I'm not a narrow specialist in the field, so you should take everything I say with a big grain of salt.
Right, and it's all not tested at this point anyway. I was just asking theoretically whether you thought it might apply.
No, this approach it's not a constant use drug because it stops apoptosis and it induces regeneration of your damaged tissues when the damage is very high.
Mm-hmm.
If the damage is not very high but constant, there should be other approaches. There may be some pure play antioxidants, things like that.
Okay. But if someone got into an acute situation for some reason, and accidents like Chernobyl are certainly one of
the
reasons.
Oh, but I mean, to me, maybe I didn't put it right, but cancer treatment is acute situation.
Right.
And we're dealing with hundreds of thousands of people which undergo potentially life-threatening treatment per year. Whereas if there are reasons to believe that excessive CAT scan can induce radioactive poisoning, type of radioactive poisoning, which is still kind of an open question.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about really very limited number of people.
I see. Okay.
And it doesn't mean that when it happens to you and you are this one person, it has to be ignored, because there is a possibility for each and every person to be in these shoes.
That's right.
If you look at the big picture, at least in our eyes, I mean, much more people are suffering from effects of really huge doses of radiation they receive in cancer treatments. And that's where we focus our efforts.
Yes, and certainly is a logical place to start. As we get more familiar with the drug and as the whole system becomes more comfortable using it, it's potentially applicable to these situations as well. But it's not, as you say, for the low-dose situation. It's really for the high-dose situation,
mm-hmm.
either an accidental overdose for some reason or the therapeutic reason where we're planning to use what is potentially a lethal dose of radiation, but is this person's last chance to kill the tumor and get rid of the tumor and survive it.
Yeah, just to give you a scale of doses which we receive in radiation treatment of cancer, we usually receive focused and split dose. But let's say if the same dose would have been applied to a whole body, I mean, it would be more than killing dose in each and every cancer treatment.
Yeah.
It's just we allow people to survive by focusing it to a narrow area of our body.
Right.
So cells can come from other sides and repair things.
Right.
But doses are huge.
Yes. Yes, the doses are huge. And sometimes that's what it takes to try to kill the tumor. And the side effects from it, as we all know, if we know anybody who's been through radiation therapy, it's not a fun experience, and there are heavy side effects. So if we can just even reduce the side effects and make it more comfortable and support this person in being more well at the end of the cycle, that would be a very good thing.
Yeah, for instance, I mean, our first trial supposed to be head and neck cancer. We should start it very soon in Roswell Park Cancer Institute.
Mm-hmm.
And there, basically, when a person is treated with radiation, this combination of radiation and some chemotherapeutic drugs, 100% of them develop mycositis. And big part of those people develop it to a degree that really cannot eat or drink. You're basically getting a tube feed, which is tremendously, tremendously inconvenient, and in many cases it causes stop of the procedure.
Mm.
By procedure, I mean radiation.
Right. So, and for head and neck patients who are getting these heavy doses of radiation, once they develop these, did you say microcytis?
Mucositis.
So
I'm sorry.
The mucous membranes get inflamed and very uncomfortable and very painful, so that people don't even want to drink or swallow or talk.
Absolutely. And I mean, they maybe want, but they cannot. I mean,
right.
The question is when they stop. Yeah.
So they really can't eat or drink normally or speak and communicate normally, all of which is very life-threatening and very uncomfortable. And that often causes people to stop the radiation therapy, which it means that while their healthy cells are getting are recovering, also the tumor is recovering.
Yeah, that's the idea, and that's what we're fighting against.
Right, so if we could continue the treatment without the nasty side effects, that would be fantastic. So it's at the Roswell Center?
Roswell Park Cancer Institute. And this is a place where company is located, where on campus of this cancer center. And
right.
What this place is famous for, it's the oldest cancer center in the country. Not the biggest, but it's a solid large center in West New York. And also this place actually developed PSA test, which is prostate antigen, which allows us to diagnose, come up with diagnostics for prostate cancer. So this place has a lot of good science and clinics done with cancer.
Could be another breakthrough. So this is Roswell Park Cancer Center in New York.
Yeah, it's in Buffalo, New York.
In Buffalo, New York.
Yeah, it's western New York.
Right, and the clinical trial is focused on head and neck cancer, which is a good place to start because of the effects that we were just talking about. And so we'll be very interested to hear how that turns out. So that's open now? It's recruiting patients?
We are about to open. It probably will take another couple of months before it will be opened, but we look with great anticipation to start this trial.
But someone could inquire now?
I think so.
And who would they contact if they wanted to inquire?
Basically, there is information. There should be information. The moment the trial is out, there will be information of our website. And the website is www.cbiolabs.com.
I'm sorry, say that again.
CBiolabs.
CBiolabs.com.
Yes.
Okay. www.cleveland.
CBiolabs. I'm sorry, not Cleveland. C. As cat.
I'm sorry, say it
again. CBiolabs.
C
as letter C, ABC.
Letter C, biolabs.com.
Yes.
Okay, and that stands for Cleveland Biolabs. And they're the makers of this product, which is CBLT502 is its lovely code name. And you're getting a lot of funding both from the medical community, from NIH, and from the defense community. Is that right?
Yeah, basically... recently, we received this highly competitive $5 million award from NIH to do basic research and clinical research in 502. And this was probably one of the most competitive awards we participated. Not the biggest award company received, but clearly one of the most competitive awards that we... It was part of the stimulus money, and I don't know how other areas of the economy received their award, but when these awards were distributed through NIH, they went through a competition which is several times harsher than usual NIH grants.
Right.
And it was very prestigious thing for us to win it.
Good.
Although, again, we are nicely supported by Department of Defense and Department of Health and Human Service at the tune of another $30 million in our defense efforts.
Great, great. Well, I certainly wish you well with your product, and I certainly hope that this testing goes through, because what you're describing here would certainly be a big benefit for everybody who is undergoing cancer treatment. And while we still need a lot of work on the preventive end, it's nice to know that there's work going on also at the therapeutic end of the spectrum so that we can improve survival even once these tumors do develop.
Well, I believe the combination of prevention, diagnostic, and improvement in treatment can make cancer more manageable. Mm-hmm. The problem with cancer is that there are so many different types of cancers that it's very, very hard to come up with a focused treatment, which will be not very harmful. But what we are addressing is how our scientific leader puts it, that where all cancers cause one disease. It's called side effects of cancer treatment. And that's what we're trying to address.
That is so true.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's exactly what people are dealing with and what we hope to help with.
I remember I was once in a conference where the doctors were debating whether the most deaths in von Hippel-Lindau disease occurred because of kidney cancer or because of brain tumors, and they were going back and forth. Finally, I stood up and I said, you know what, you couldn't prove either one by me. I think the leading cause of death in people with VHL is complications from surgery.
It's very much what
you just said. I mean, complications from the therapies, we also have to worry about and make sure that we're doing our very best to reduce mistakes and counteract the bad effects of whatever medications are in there to do us good. But sometimes a little bit more of it is not good for us, even though it may be good for killing the tumor.
It's extremely, extremely delicate balance. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, people in the media and people in the policy, they attract our attention to, you know, do no harm concept.
Right.
However, in cancer, this is not necessarily the only approach or the right approach, because when you're dealing with a disease which really, I mean, life-threatening to the extent cancer is,
mm-hmm.
even high-risk treatments are really beneficial. Because, I'm sorry to say, but if you have advanced cancer disease, I mean, chance of survival are not very high, I mean, they're very low.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you have very aggressive treatment, I mean, each person at some sense takes a gamble.
Yes.
But chances of survival can be dramatically increased, although chances of therapeutic death can be very high too.
Yes.
And how to judge those situations, it is a very complicated ethical issue.
It is. But as you said in the beginning, it's a risk-benefit calculation. We always have to say, okay, what is the risk, but at the same time, what is the potential benefit, and where's the balance point in there? Am I willing to put myself at that much risk in order to try for the potential benefit? And as you say, there's no easy answer to that question. You have to evaluate each situation as it comes up.
No, I mean, I absolutely agree with you. I only want to stress that, first of all, the decision should belong more to a person whose health is at risk. And in many cases, aggressive and risky treatments can be quite justifiable if a disease is something which is deadly as cancer.
Right. I mean, for example, there's an ad on television that says, oh, we have this wonderful drug that will kill the fungus in your toenail. Of course, it will put your kidneys at risk. And it's like,
yeah.
Excuse me, the potential benefit that curing my toe fungus is not worth putting my kidney at risk. So for every potential treatment, we should be doing this sort of risk-benefit analysis. And when it comes to cancer treatment, and the stakes are higher, when it's, yes, this treatment could cause nasty side effects, but it may be the only way to kill your tumor, those kinds of decisions become much more delicate and should rightfully belong to the patient. And only to the patient, and the rest of us around them can give them the information that they can use to make an informed decision, but they really should be ones deciding whether or not to go through it.
Yeah.
Yeah, but thank you. This would make things a lot more comfortable. I don't see any questions from our callers, so just remind everybody that if they'd like to call in with a question, the phone number to call is 347-237-4358, or you can put your questions into the chat room if you wish. There's a chat room online at blogtalkradio.com. I have one question for you from the chat line. So in terms of administering this after, let's say that there is some sort of terrorist attack, we'll worry about the dirty bomb scenario. So then you would be distributing this through civil defense channels, and everybody would have to get their inoculation within 48 hours if they were close enough to the point of attack?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. But it's not us. It will be civil defense authorities. Probably it will be firefighters.
Uh-huh. Right. I'm in the emergency response team for my community, and
it depends upon scale of event.
What they call dispensing drills. You know, in the case of any kind of an emergency, then we might need to dispense some medication, and so when we do the flu clinics, we consider that a dispensing drill.
Yeah.
Yeah. So communities hopefully are organizing themselves so that in this kind of an emergency, they could handle this kind of a dispensing situation.
But there are governmental programs in place which actually to a degree I know about them, and I don't have the highest clearance. They make a lot of sense.
Right.
The question is, there should be a staff in the box to distribute, and we're working on it.
Right. And at the same time, it's that same thing that we're dealing with medically. There's prevention and then there's cure. And prevention is a lot easier in many cases than cure. But in the case where we need the cure, it's nice to know that there are things like this on the horizon. And again, this product is not yet fully tested. It is very much of interest, and it is looking good in the lab, and still has some testing ahead of it.
Oh, yeah. I don't want to cause misunderstanding that it's that all testings are finished, completed, sealed, and bound.
Right.
We are in the FDA process. We have human safety. We have animal efficacy, but we need to bring more of each to have this product approved. And we expect it will happen reasonably soon.
Right. Just in the testing that you've done so far, you've been saying that it seems to be well tolerated by the animals that have taken.
And humans.
So
because we did test safety in humans. Obviously, you cannot test efficacy in humans.
Right. So in human volunteers, you were able to test that it's safe. So what kinds of side effects?
You have some degree of fever, not really high degree. I mean, degree at which I usually go to work if I have it. But obviously, you have tremendously intensive regeneration of your blood and some other elements of your body. Obviously, it's a fever-like feeling from 2 to 6 hours, and various degree, but highest degree is below grade 2, so it's a modest fever. And it doesn't happen to each and every person, but frankly speaking, when you're dealing with life-threatening dose of radiation, fever probably should be least concern of anybody involved.
Absolutely. So you said that with radiation poisoning, the bone marrow and the small intestine are the ones that seem to be at the greatest risk?
Well, there are also, it depends upon the dose. So if you talk about doses which kill mammals, I mean, basically they die from combination of hematopoietic syndrome, which is inability to restore blood, and gastrointestinal syndrome, which is basically destruction of guts. If you go to higher doses, there is also lung toxicity and toxicity towards neurons, neurocells. But in real-life scenarios, non-clinical scenarios, I mean, basically, you need to be too close to the nuclear epicenter, and probably you'll be killed by other factors.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So really, most of the casualties in all scenarios which originate from radiation part of nuclear attack, mm-hmm. die through those two syndromes which we deal with.
Right. So when you say the restoration of the blood, it's the bone marrow that creates the red blood cells.
Mm-hmm. Red and white. Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. And so I didn't understand completely in the material that I was going through
mm-hmm.
that there's some erythropoietin effect?
There is not only erythropoiesis, but there's also thrombopoiesis. I mean, we actually support all blood lineages, because in order to be alive, you need to have all blood lineages. You also need to have white blood cells functional. And drug does three things. It protects progenitors or stem cells.
Okay.
It pushes proliferation of those, so you need less to repopulate because they divide faster.
Mm-hmm.
It also produces cytokines, which actually do this. So drug both protects from primary damage by blocking apoptosis and induces proliferation. So you have a lot of, you know, signaling molecules in our blood which push our body parts to do this.
Okay. So it's supporting our ability to make new cells.
Absolutely.
Supporting the regeneration capabilities that our bodies normally have
mm-hmm.
that have been suppressed by the radiation.
And yes.
So
and radiation...
bring that back.
Yes, it is suppressed, and also radiation does kill a lot of those cells, so you would need less alive cells to come back to norm.
Okay. And then the small intestine is the one that's primarily in charge of absorbing nutrients into our bloodstream. So we may eat something, but until the small intestine really takes the good stuff out of that MASH that our stomach has produced, it's not in a form that can go and nourish ourselves.
No, unfortunately, it's a nasty thing. I mean, if you have radiation poisoning in this area, unfortunately, you have basically physical destruction of small intestine. And then it's quite, we are a host of more bacterial cells than there are human cells in our body. But they're compartmentalized, they're separated from an area where they actually do nothing bad or maybe do something good from areas where they can kill you immediately. Mm-hmm. So if you lose integrity of your gastrointestinal tract and bacteria go out, human is very dead very soon.
So there are bacteria that normally live in our intestine in order to digest our food.
Yeah.
And
for whatever reasons they are there. But there are a few pounds of them.
Okay. So there are a few pounds of these bacteria there, and normally they're kept contained within that small intestine. But if the cell structure of the small intestine breaks down, then they can escape into our bodies and begin to poison us.
And then basically you have acute bacteriemia and septic shock, and you really die very fast. And don't forget that blood damage reduces your ability of your immune system to deal with this. So this is a combination of those three things.
So it's letting loose an infection, which the weakened bloodstream is not able to counteract, and then everything gets worse really fairly rapidly.
Yeah.
Right.
And this is a very, very unpleasant way to go.
Right, right.
I doubt that there are pleasant way to go, but
This is true. It's not so nice to exit one way or another, but it sounds like your drug is targeting these two primary areas that would support people in surviving this kind of damage.
Yes.
Great. Well, thank you so much. This has really been great. I appreciate your sharing all this good information with us, and we will look forward to hearing the results of this clinical trial. So perhaps when it's over, you could come back and give us a report about it.
Thank you. I'll be happy to.
Thank you so much. Well, and thank you, everybody, for joining us today. And we will certainly be talking about more exciting news next week. We haven't quite finalized the booking for next week, but I will share that with you online at thepowerfulpatient.org. So be sure to go to powerfulpatient.org. There's a handout that will go with this show. It'll be posted by tomorrow, and you'll get the full website. Again, it's cbiolabs.com, letter C, BIOLABS.com, that you can learn more about CBLT-502. And thank you very much, Dr. Feinstein, for being with us.
Oh, thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Great. And again, this program is brought to you every week by the VHL Family Alliance. You'll find out more about VHL at vhl.org. And I hope that everybody has a great week. So be well and be a powerful patient. Thanks so much. Bye.
Thank you very much. Goodbye.